I'll put my contact. I will put my contact in the chat so you have it, and if any questions arise after, you can always get in hold of me. So just a few reminders before we get started. A copy of the PowerPoint as well as related files are on our webpage, nysrti.org, and then under Professional Development, Current Webinars in Strand 23. I'll throw the link in the chat in a minute too. And all upcoming professional development opportunities can be found on our webpage. Just check frequently if you're interested in anything upcoming. During today's webinar, please use the chat box for any questions or comments that you may have. And at the end of today's webinar, we will share a link to a brief evaluation. Please take a few minutes to complete that. We do appreciate the feedback. And today we're pleased to have with us to present the third webinar in a five-session webinar strand, Strand 23, using Universal Design for Learning. To support Tier 1 instruction. Today's topic is barriers in curriculum, teachers as designers, and we're excited to have back with us today two UDL implementation specialists from CAST, Melissa Sanjay and Bill Wilmot. And at this time, it is my pleasure to welcome back Melissa and Bill.
Thank you very much, Molly. Excited to be here. Again, my name is Bill Wilmot. I'm an implementation specialist at CAST. And Melissa Sanjay is joining me as well. I'm going to do most of the presenting, and Melissa is going to be on the chat. Melissa, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. Hi, everyone. I'm Melissa Sanjay. I'll be here in the chat. Throw in your questions, throw in comments. We want to keep this as active and interactive as possible.
Excellent. Thank you for reminding us all of that. The goal is for us to revolutionize the webinar format and get everybody active and chatting as we go. So, Molly, if we could advance to a couple of slides. As you know, next slide, UDL is all about providing options. So think about some options that will help support your expert learning today. If you need fidgets, now's a good time to grab them. Something to take notes with, post-its. We're going to be doing an activity via webinar later, so I have all of my post-its ready to go. If options for action and expression, definitely jump in on the chat. Raise your hand. There's a little figure at the top where you can do that to ask questions, and you can follow along, as Molly said, on the slides. You can follow along with our projection. All right, let's get started. So the goals for today, next slide. The goals for today are to revisit and strengthen the concept that the barrier is in the curriculum or the environment. When we use the word curriculum, we really mean that quite broadly to include the curriculum materials, the method of instruction, assessment, and the learning environment, and even the learning goal. So if I use the word curriculum and talk about barriers in the curriculum, I really mean all of those things. I'm going to introduce you to a tool called journey mapping, and we'll practice that tool a little bit. As a way of practicing it, we're going to do a short little sample lesson, which we'll get to later. And then we're going to distinguish the different roles of the teacher. All right, so let's get started with that. I want to start by having you think about your own context. So this is a way of thinking about a goal for your context. What is most exciting in your classroom right now, and what are you most concerned about in your classroom right now? And if you're not in a classroom, think of the learning context that you are in. So feel free to share that in the chat. What are you most excited about in your classroom right now, and what are you most concerned about? Melissa is most excited about the engagements of the participants. That's also a nice hint for us all that we should be engaging. And Melissa's concerned about offering enough access points for people who are at different levels of understanding. Okay, as we move along, definitely throw things in the chat that you are excited about and most concerned about. All right, let's go to the next slide. So with those excitements and concerns, think about your goal for your classroom today. So you can think about your goal for your own learning, but your learning on behalf of all of those students in your classroom. So what's your goal that you want to come out of today for your classroom? Jennifer is looking for new ideas to better help her students. Thank you, Jennifer. Bobby's goal for today is to strengthen my skills in the TSS process that I can transfer to others. Thank you, Bobby. Welcome back. And Melissa, to provide people with usable tools and information. The journey mapping is going to be a little bit challenging to do via webinar, but I find it an incredibly helpful tool. Especially when you're working on co-teaching or you're working in a coaching situation or even as a self-reflection tool on your own. So that's why I wanted to incorporate it in here. And it's a really great way to look at barriers in the curriculum and identifying barriers. It really helps you kind of put the design of the instruction outside of yourself so you can critically examine it. All right, let's jump in and go to the next slide. So just a quick review. We have talked about how UDL fits into RTI and really plays a major role in Tier 1 instruction and making Tier 1 instruction as accessible as possible. But we really see UDL as applicable in all of the tiers of instruction. And that becomes more challenging as you move into Tier 2 and Tier 3 interventions because the nature of those interventions is often much more focused. And so it feels like there's much less flexibility in terms of how those interventions happen. But in reality, there are still clear learning goals that we're pursuing, and the there's still clear learning goals that that we're pursuing, and we can design options into those learning goals. So we really see UDL as applying to all three tiers of instruction. So quick review of the UDL core concepts from previous webinars for those who weren't there or who just would be helpful to have a good review. We introduced the idea of universal design in the context of architecture. And from that, we learned that the barrier is in the environment. We looked at neuroscience, and in our examination of neuroscience, really looked at variability, spent all of the last webinar on variability, and learned that variability is the norm, and that really across the whole spectrum of human learners, there's a wide variety of approaches in terms of engagement, in terms of how they best receive information, and in terms of how they express what they know in response to that instruction. So variability really is the norm. If you walk into your classroom of 20 learners, you have 20 different approaches to learning. Among the 7 participants that we have online right now, we have 7 different approaches to learning. And finally, we talked about the guidelines, and we're going to go much more in depth on the guidelines in subsequent webinars. But the guidelines, the goal of the guidelines is expert learning and developing an expertise in learning. And that's not, we don't think of that as a destination, but we think of that as a process, an ongoing process of engaging in learning. And with each stage of that expert learning, taking over more and more responsibility for your own learning. So we're going to watch a quick video on design thinking here. And just listen to this and think about how this could potentially apply in your work as a teacher.
Design pervades our world. I think that if everyone approaches the world with a sense of optimism, with a sense of making things better, that for me is the power of design.
I have a science background, and so I've always been a science geek. And to me, design is very much like a scientific process, and it's all about taking what we think we know, bringing it to a new space with a deeper understanding.
Design is really about intentionality. It's being aware of and being sort of cognizant of all of the sort of interstitial spaces between the kind of obvious moments of change.
Design means a lot of things to me. At its most functional level, it's solving problems. At a somewhat less functional level, it's solving problems with elegance and beauty. In some cases, it's about creating new things that make people's lives better. It's an act of people coming together, recognizing challenges, creating better versions of the future, and then trying to manifest those things as tangibly and as meaningfully as possible.
Even something as simple as, you know, driving your car, right? You're like, well, I get my car and I like drive away. It's like, well, no. There's opening the car, there's sitting down, there's getting the key in the ignition or whatever, hitting the ignition button if you have a fancy car. And design is about, gives you a lens into thinking about making sure that all of those steps add up to the thing that you want it to be.
So we could look at design as a noun, the thing that's been designed, but I really like it as a verb. I like it as action, right? Design is a process, but it's also a mindset. It's a state that I'm in. Being a designer means wanting to transform the world around you. Design is a way of seeing what's around you and having ideas about how things could be different or better. It's the way I'm looking at the world. I'm looking at it to see how can I make it better, and I'm choosing to do something about it. That to me is what being a designer is about. Design is at its core about problem solving. It's taking, you know, a bit of the art where, you know, art to a certain extreme is more about interpretation, but it's really looking at how to make anything a bit better.
I think that idea that they talk about there of design as problem solving, and designers are about creating better versions of the future. I feel like that's what we're trying to do in classrooms every day. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about our role as teachers, as designers. We think of teachers, so I Googled teachers and found all of these images on Google Images. These are some of the first images of teachers that come up. As we go through them, you'll see a lot of people standing in front of classrooms. They all seem to be teaching math, which is a common theme. But a lot of people standing in front of classrooms, writing on the blackboard and talking to students. I Googled teachers around the world, and I got very similar pictures. Occasionally, you'll get a picture like this, which involves, which makes you think that students may be a little bit more involved, but it's still pretty much teacher talking to students. And I think this really is built around a myth about teaching. You may remember this movie, a great Robin Williams movie, Dead Poets Society, which kind of embodies the myth that teachers walk into the classroom, they magically inspire students to love learning, and as you know, after about 10 minutes of teaching, it doesn't actually work that way. There's a lot of planning that goes into teaching. There's a lot of working with colleagues that goes into teaching. There's a lot of that, a lot of grading that goes into teaching. And so I want to break down the role of the teacher into kind of three parts: the instructor, the coach, and the designer. And then we're going to dive into the designer role a little bit more as a way of thinking about barriers in the curriculum. So the instructor is in the role of giving information, giving directions, providing context, and managing the classroom. The coach inspires, motivates, monitors, gives feedback, and redirects. And we'll go into teacher as designer in just a second. Here is, again, another video from IDEO, which is, they're really the leaders on design thinking and have started to really influence how design thinking can be used in education. So here are some interviews that they did with teachers about using design thinking in education. Molly. I love those perspectives on thinking about teachers as designers. We really are designing learning experiences as one way to think about it. And that includes the curriculum, it includes the assessment, it includes how you set up your classroom, and it includes how you design the instruction. So a teacher as a designer is goal-directed, they're intentional, they're proactive, flexible, learner-centered. They're guided by empathy and understanding. of the learner experience. They're guided by principles and research, and they're always brainstorming new ideas. And one part that's easy to forget is that it's always an iterative process. It's never a process that's done. And so it's a reflective process, and teachers are always seeking feedback and engaged in that ongoing improvement. And those align well with the way that we talked in previous webinars about the phases of the UDL design process. Their teachers as designers are goal-directed. They're proactive, so they're always thinking about what the possible barriers are. They're guided by principles like the UDL guidelines. And they're always going back and feeding back on what they've done before. Here's another way of looking at it. So here's your classroom. Let's put some tables in the classroom. The first thing that you do before you even walk into the classroom is think about, all right, what's my learning goal today? And then you start thinking about, well, how am I going to get there? And then as you're getting there, as you're thinking about how you're going to get there, you might be using the UDL guidelines to help you plan that. And then you're going to inevitably confront barriers that that learners are going to face, just based on the predictable variability that is kind of built into the design of the guidelines. And all of that is before the learners even walk into the classroom. So there the learners are, and you realize, wow, they're all very different. And then as you get to know them, you realize they're even more different than I thought. And then you start to, once you get to know your learners, you start to be able to think about what are some of the options that I could provide that would be really useful. So there are some different options for approaching the learning goal. And then you, as the instructor, come into the classroom. So as you can see, that teacher as a designer is an incredibly complicated job, and a lot of it happens before you even walk into the classroom, whereas teacher as instructor and teacher as coach are ongoing and happening all the time when you're in the classroom. So just a quick reminder of the UDL process. We start by setting clear and relevant goals, then we anticipate barriers, and then we design options to reduce barriers for everyone. So another representation of that process to help us see the cyclical nature of it. The important thing once you've created a learning design is that you've got to try it out. And that's where the self-reflection and the iterative process really becomes crucial. Try it out. How did it go? And then feed that back into the process of setting goals and redesigning what you've done. So here's a little analogy of comparing teachers as designers to car designers. So let's think about the parallel between car design and curriculum design. Jacqueline pointed out a parallel to a fashion designer that she knows. Right, and having to think about variability in the context of fashion design. That's a great connection. All right, so let's think about the car design. All right, so the car is going to be our curriculum. That's our learning environment. The car designer designed cars. The teacher as a designer designs curriculum and designs the learning environment. The driver is the learner. That's the person we're designing the car for. That's who we're designing the curriculum for. And what we're designing is not just the car, but we're designing a learning experience. We're not designing just curriculum, but a curriculum experience or a driving experience. The car designer is the teacher as designer. The destination is your learning goal. Where are we headed? Now, the route to get there could be variable. right? There could be different routes for different drivers. I think this is one of the things that's crucial about thinking about how to implement UDL, is that not everybody's going to take the same route. So as a curriculum designer, you're going to provide different means, different options, different instructional methods even, different ways of representing the information or allowing students to act on or express what they know. You're going to provide those options almost like you would have different routes for different drivers. Some days you'll have students who might want to take the scenic route. Some days you'll have certain students who might like to take the scenic route often. So then you have unpredictable things that happen, right? The deer in the road, and you have to change up right at that moment as the driver. And the learning environment, as much as you design it, is going to be inherently unpredictable, right? Everybody comes in with new information each day and a new experience each day. The interaction between students is going to be unpredictable, and that can be valuable, and you can take advantage of that. The driver's ed classroom instructor is kind of the parallel to the teacher as instructor. It's someone who's in a controlled environment delivering information and delivering structure, delivering the overall context. And then the driver's ed instructor, when they're in the car with you, is almost the teacher as coach. You're playing everything from the car designer at Ford role to the driver's ed instructor in the car sitting next to the new driver. So this is why teaching is so complicated, is you're playing all of these different roles at the same time. It highlights how important that teacher as a designer role is, because it sets up all of the other roles. So let's look at an example. So there's our accelerator and our brake pedal. Now imagine we had an innovative car designer who decided that they wanted to shake things up. They were going to revolutionize the car world. They decided they wanted to reverse the brake pedal and the accelerator. Maybe a little bit of a flawed idea, but this was their great innovation. The drivers, of course, had to adapt, and they had to learn a new way of doing things. And inevitably, there were some accidents along the way. So we might call that a design flaw, right? That's not a very good revolutionary idea. And probably not one that car designers would ever consider. But let's think about something more practical, like how far apart the brake and gas pedal are. Right? That's probably something that they think about all of the time. You need to be able to get from the gas pedal to the brake pedal really quickly. So you could imagine a car where they're too far apart. That's a design flaw and something that they'll have to think about all the time. And, of course, designers, I'm sure car designers, when they're on their lunch breaks, are complaining about drivers and how drivers are not great at adapting to their design innovations. But at some point, it's just a design flaw. So here's a real-life story of a design flaw, or maybe it's just me as a bad driver. It's Christmas Eve, probably 2-3 years ago, Christmas Eve. I'm driving to New York with my family. My wife has a Prius. This is the shifter of a Prius. And as we're driving down the highway, almost to New York City, there is a freak snowstorm, like buckets of snow. And I'm talking to people from Buffalo, so you know what this is like. Buckets of snow all at once. And so everybody slows down on the highway to 20 miles per hour. And even with that, there's congestion building up because there are quite a few cars on the road, and it's getting late at night, and there's all this snow. So I am driving, and I start to see red brake lights in front of me, and I know that I have to slow down. I know if I slam on the brakes, I'm going to slide all over the highway, and so I know that I should downshift, and I look down to this fancy new car. It doesn't have the click, click, click shifter on the side of the steering wheel. It has this, and I have no idea, looking at that, how to downshift, and I don't have a lot of time to figure it out. Well, it turns out that the B on there is how you downshift. In order to shift into drive, you push it to the left and then push down. In order to shift into drive, into reverse, you push it to the left and push up. And it keeps going back to where that circle is. And in order to downshift, you have to push it down to B. But I did not figure that out in time. I still have no idea what B stands for. It should be something like one or downshift or something like that. So anyway, I end up in a seven-car pileup in the middle of 95 on my way through Connecticut to New York because of the what I would call a design flaw in the shifter of the Prius. But perhaps I should have figured out how to downshift the Prius before I got into the car. So you see, that's a great example of where the interaction of the design and the user, of the curriculum design and the learner, is crucial. Of course, the learner has to adapt to new things coming at them, but the curriculum should be made as accessible as possible with as few barriers as possible. For me, on December 24th, driving down 95 with a Prius, that B was a barrier to my learning. All right, so as we've talked about, where do we focus our attention when we're thinking about curriculum design? Often we have focused our attention on the left, on the learner. But UDL actually asks us to shift our attention from the learner to focusing on the barrier, and how do we minimize the barriers on behalf of the learner. So let's imagine now a lesson, okay? We're going to design a lesson about butterfly metamorphosis. Here's our goal. We want people to understand, students understand butterfly metamorphosis, okay? There are our learners. We want to get them closer to that goal. There's our classroom and our learners. We want to get them to that goal. We give them a pile of books. Here are a bunch of books about butterfly metamorphosis. Now, the problem with that is that the books, the reading that's involved in the books, the decoding, the comprehension, may present a barrier to learning. So let's think about how we might redesign that. There's our goal. We want everybody to understand butterfly metamorphosis. There are learners. We'll still give them those books because there are some learners who are going to engage and be excited about learning through books. There might be others who are excited about listening to something, a series of videos, books on tape, even a series of webinars, perhaps. And then there might be some who could better be served by engaging with videos or a website of different resources that they could explore and engage with. So the idea there is that we want to provide different options for engaging with the curriculum, for pursuing our learning goal, so that we meet the needs of a broader set of learners. So now, I want to move into journey mapping now and think about how are we going to identify some of those barriers as a way so that we can then redesign and design to minimize those barriers. Okay, so here are some links to a couple of documents that you can look at now or you can look at later. You don't need them for the activity that we're going to be doing, but if you wanted to do journey mapping on your own later, these would be useful guiding documents. The top one gives you the basic instructions of journey mapping, and there are kind of three different roles that we'll go over in a minute in the journey mapping process. And then the second document is a link to an individual journey mapping template. So So this picture here is the map, is a picture of the result of the journey mapping process. If you in the three phases of UDL design process, journey mapping is really most helpful in anticipating barriers and designing to minimize barriers. All right, so what is a journey map? Journey map is really a visual map of an experience. And there are two ways to use it. You can use it proactively in anticipation of, for instance, a learning experience, or you can use it retrospectively. You can use it to reflect on something that's happened before. So we're going to use it retrospectively today because we're going to have a little learning experience, and then we're going to jump in and journey map our own learning experience. Okay. Each of the parts of a journey map, the top lane, these horizontal bars are called lanes. The top lane is mapping out the activities of an experience. So in a learning experience, we'll map out each of the individual moves that happen throughout the learning experience. The second layers are, the second, third, and fourth layers are really designed to put yourself in the user's shoes and to anticipate or record the emotional experience of the users. So this one, it has a student emotion map, and we're going to map your emotions to the learning experience that we're going to do later. And it also is used to anticipate potential barriers. So if you see that the blue dots here has low and high spots, at the end they end with a low spot, that's a potential barrier, and we might want to dig into why was that a potential, why was that a low spot emotionally. Then the second lane here is just whatever materials and tools that you use for the learning experience. I taught chemistry last year, and I could really have used journey mapping in designing labs for chemistry because there are so many materials and tools that you need. Getting all of that organized really requires kind of walking through it in your mind. If you've ever planned a big party or a wedding or something like that, you will recognize that journey mapping is something that you probably did at somewhere along the way, even if you didn't write it down or didn't do it consciously. You're kind of trying to walk through the experience that people are having as they're coming to your party. This example one also has a teacher emotion map. I like to include that because the power of journey mapping is that you can include as many different lanes as you want, and they can be whatever you want them to be. So I always put an other lane at the bottom because you can add new things on to that experience. So where does this come from? It really comes from the design world, and it's used in everything from software design to the design of packaging. The designer's goals are that everything is intentional, it's centered around the user experience, and so here are a few examples of the results. I'm going to run through these quickly. So everybody has been to Amazon. Amazon has carefully designed their website so that they can sell you books and all of the other things that they sell you. Zooming in on one part of the website, they've got this the part where you buy it. Everything on Amazon always seems to be on sale. There's the list price and the sale price, but always the sale price is in red and it always seems to be on sale. They tell you exactly when you're going to get it. And now they've added buy now with one click. So you don't have to do the two steps of adding it to your cart and then checking out. You can just go straight to checkout. Amazon's goal is, of course, to sell you things and for you to not drift away from their website while you're browsing and while you're looking at things. Now, the teacher's goal is not necessarily to sell things, though sometimes it does feel like we have to sell exciting material like solving two-step equations. All right, I don't know if you've ordered from Domino's recently, but here is how they get you excited about your pizza. When you go to order, as soon as you click on pizza, you get a picture of your pizza there. And then as you add toppings, they say, do you want cheese on that? No thanks, or yes. And then you, as you add toppings, you see I've added hot sauce here, they actually add the toppings right on the picture. Yes, I clicked on hot sauce, but actually I only want hot sauce on half because only one of my kids likes hot sauce. The other one likes ham, but both of them like bacon, so we'll put that on the whole pizza. As soon as you go to checkout, they say, do you want bread twists with that? Yes, in big letters. No, in tiny letters. And then once you order, it asks you if you'd like updates via cell phone. And then, I don't know if you can see it, but here's the Domino's tracker. Your pizza is being prepped. Luciano began custom making your order at 7:17 p.m. Now it's baking, and now it's out for delivery. Eddie left the store at 7:30 p.m. And there's my son with his bread twist. All of that is designed very intentionally to get you excited, to keep you going with your order, and to make you come back for more. I went to a designer's studio one time, and they were designing packaging for a phone. And they were using this journey mapping process to map out the process of opening up your phone so that they could think about what was the experience. How do you make that experience as exciting as possible to open up all the different layers and gadgets in your new phone? So that's how designers think, very intentionally, very centered on what is the user's experience. So comparing that to teachers as designers, everything is intentional. Everything's centered around the learner for teachers. We're mapping a learning experience, and our goal is to anticipate barriers. Not barriers to purchasing, but barriers to learning. All right, as David Rose says, all learning is the interaction between the learner and the environment. And the tool that we have available to us is to design the environment, to redesign the environment. So when would you use journey mapping in a teaching context? Well, if you're testing out a new learning design idea, something that you've never done before, you want to try small group discussions, or you want to try a writer's workshop, it might be useful to project out what you think is going to happen and what are going to be the high points and low points for your learners. If you're reflecting back on a learning design and trying to figure out what went well, what didn't go well, where were the barriers, even if you're thinking in the context of a particular class or a particular student, you could journey map a lesson and then try to anticipate or even use the journey mapping process as a way of talking with your students and getting feedback from them on what the experience was like. All right, we're now going to dive into the sample lesson. All right, so you have to put yourself back into the experience of being in high school, because this is going to be some high school content. And we're going to go through a lesson on solving systems of equations using the substitution method. So we'll start the scene here. I will be your instructor. So as you remember, class, yesterday we did solving systems of equations using the elimination method. Today we're using the substitution method. You can solve for one of the variables in one of the equations and then substitute that into the other equation. So that's the topic. This is a topic that you might use when you're trying to think about how two different trends interact with each other and where there might be intersections between two trends. All right, so remember we did the elimination method yesterday. By the end of this lesson, you're going to be able to solve a system of equations using the substitution method, and you'll do that independently. And I'll ask for some volunteers to do that in our chat when we're done with this. Okay, so there's our system of equation. We've got 3x plus 5y equals 26, and we've got x minus y equals negative 2. And we want to find the value of x and y. So the first thing that we do is find the value of one of those by simplifying one of the equations. So let's pick the simplest equation. Anybody have a preference of which equation we pick? Which one looks simplest? Any hands raised? We have a couple of people. All right, let's go with the x minus y. Thank you, Bobby. We'll go with the x minus y equals negative 2. So let's solve that. The simplest way looks like if we isolate the x variable. So let's add y to both sides. And we end up with the equation x equals y minus 2. So now we know what the value of x is in terms of y. So the second step is to take that value of x, and we're going to substitute it into our second equation. Our second equation is 3x plus 5y equals 26. For the x, we're going to substitute in y minus 2, because we know that x equals y minus 2. So 3 parentheses y minus 2 plus 5y equals 26. Now we're going to simplify this equation. We'll distribute that 3, so we end up with 3y minus 6 plus 5y equals 26. Okay, we keep simplifying. We'll add 6 to both sides. We end up with 8y equals 32. I did two steps in one there. I combined 3y plus 5y, and 26 plus 6 equals 32. So 8y equals 32. Simplify that, and we get y equals 4. Divide both sides by 8. All right, so now we know what y equals. The next step is to go back to the first equation that we started with. We know that y equals 4. We're going to substitute that value into the first equation, which gives us x minus 4 equals negative 2. To simplify that, we're going to add 4 to both sides. Negative 2 plus 4 is 2. So we get the value x equals 2. So there's our answer. X equals 2 and y equals 4. All right, so now we've just solved a system of equations, a simultaneous equation, using the substitution method. We found the value of x in terms of y, and we substituted that value into the second equation, and we found the value of y. We then took that value of y and substituted it into the first equation and solved that and got our value for x. Okay? Now, you are going to do a problem on your own. 4x plus 6y equals 40. And the second equation is x plus y equals 5. And your goal is to find the value of x and y using the substitution method. So you're going to do this on your own, and I'm looking for volunteers in the chat to show their work and to give us the answer. I'm expecting at any moment for participants to start fleeing. So that's the end of our math lesson, all right? That's the end of the scene. So math is always a good way to get an emotional reaction from folks, especially when you ask them to do it on their own. So that's why I chose a math example. We're now going to take that example, and we're going to use that to learn the journey mapping process. Anybody having heart palpitations from reviewing high school math? The other reason I chose it is because I taught math and science, so it's my native language, if not everyone else's. All right. So let's map this out. We're going to end with something. We'll end up with something that will look like this. These are the different steps of that. Here are the various roles of journey mapping. The first role is the facilitator. They kind of interview the teacher. They interview the teacher so that they can be really specific about what all of the activities were that we went through. Melissa is going to play the role of the facilitator. I'm going to be the instructor. The instructor's job when being interviewed is to, in minute detail, kind of outline all of the things that they did as a part of their lesson. And they do this with the help of the facilitator. So the facilitator is always prompting for more detail. And then finally, there's the sticky note writer. This person's job is to concisely record what the instructor is saying, one note per sticky note, one idea per sticky note. I have steered us around the sticky note writer by pre-writing a lot of the sticky notes, though if we notice anything that's missing, we can add that in. All right, Melissa, are you ready on the other end?
I'm ready to map.
Okay, ready to map. So Melissa, take it away. Melissa's going to facilitate, and we're going to switch over to a large video and get rid of the slides so that you can hopefully see what I'm writing up there as much as possible. I'm going to move us as close as I can. So these are our different lanes. This is the activities lane. These are the materials. This is the learner experience. And this is that other section. All right, go for it, Melissa.
I just want to note, Bill, for a second, that if you want to make Bill's video full screen, you can click the four arrows going in different directions on the top right of your picture.
Great, thank you.
So now you're full screen. So we are going to map your learning experience, Bill. So the first question we will ask you is, what did you do first? What was your first activity?
Well, the first thing I did was introduce the topic and tell people that we were going to be solving systems of equations using the substitution method.
Okay. And for that, what materials did you need?
Well, in this case, I was using mostly the slides. And in fact, I was just using slides so that people could see it on the webinar.
Okay. And so what was next? After you introduced the topic, what did you do next?
So I introduced the goal, which was for people to independently solve systems of equations. And so when I'm journey mapping that, we put that all the way to the right. I'm putting it as far to the right as I can. So that independently solves systems of equations. That was my goal, using the substitution method. And then I introed the method of solving the systems of equations. And I also reminded people about the day before we did systems of equations using the elimination method. And I did that so that I could point back to something we had done before and then introduce substitution as a method of solving.
Okay. And after that, what did you need any sources for that, or were you still using the slides?
We were still using the slides. So basically, through the whole thing, the only material was the slides. Pause on the journey mapping. You can imagine if you're doing a lesson in a classroom, you're going to have a lot more materials. So as your activities get outlined up here, this becomes almost a timeline for your lesson, and then these are the materials. One interesting thing to look at with the activities is who is doing all of these things, right? In a classroom, you really want a mix of teacher doing things and student doing things. So the next thing that we did is I introduced that the goal is to find the value of X and Y.
Okay, and then after that?
After that, I asked people to identify the simplest equation for us to start from.
Okay.
And then
so you asked the students to identify the simplest equation. Then your next step?
Well, then students actually responded. Bobby responded and Melissa responded. So I'm going to add that one up there.
Okay.
And then I had people simplify the first equation. Right? We solved for x. Yes, we solved for x. And then we substituted that value into the second equation. So we substituted y minus 2 into the second equation. And then we solved the second equation for y. And then finally, last two steps, we substitute the y value into the first equation. And then I had students solve a problem on their own. And then with the next step of sharing that with the class. I forgot to write that one. So sharing work was the last step. Okay. So you can see how the process of journey mapping is pretty straightforward. Here you're just kind of mapping out each of the activities, each of the things that happens over the course of the of a lesson or of an experience. Now, the next part is where it becomes more interesting. Melissa, you want to take us into the emotion map?
Sure. So as you look at each of your steps and you look over everything that happened, what do you see as your high points? What were the high points of the lesson?
So we're going to actually create an emotion map with people telling us what your high points and low points are. Did my webcam go off?
I think I might have done something. Molly, can you fix that for me? I think I made mine small and I somehow turned yours off. Sorry about that, Bill.
Not a problem. All right, I think we're back on.
Yes, you're back on.
All right, so we need a little bit of participation from folks here. What was your high point? What was your low point? Maybe the high point was as soon as I said we were going to be doing systems of equations because you have fond memories of your algebra teacher from high school. Or maybe that was a low point. Maybe sharing your work was a high point, or maybe that was a low point. So think about what your high points and low points were. I use the words high and low intentionally and keep it rather vague because the goal is they could be the most engaged moment and least engaged. It could be the most excited or least excited. Could be happy and sad. But there could be sad, engaged moments, too. So anybody have a high point or a low point that they want to throw out? We're going to go down to this learner emotion lane. This is the kind of the neutral point, much like you would see in handwriting in early grades. This is our center line. So each person will have a different color on the learner emotion map. So Melissa's high point was the big reveal because she got the right answer. So the big reveal was around here. So we'll put a sticky note there. We'll put it up high, indicating that is Melissa's high point.
So Bobby's high point was getting the numbers for both variables.
All right. So also, same when we got the answer, same as Melissa. Okay. What about low points? Anybody have any low points?
I I would say my low point was the step-by-step pacing because I wanted it to go quicker.
You wanted it to go quicker. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So it went very slowly. So this is kind of that whole process where we're simplifying the first equation, substituting the value of x. So throughout that process, is that about the right place?
Yeah, it's about where I got impatient.
Okay.
Got another one coming in here.
Bobby, did you have a low point? If anybody else has highs and lows, feel free to jump in.
Bobby's low point was we didn't check to make sure our answer was correct.
Ah, okay. Bobby, you should be teaching this class. So Bobby went quickly from a high point to a low point here because I forgot to substitute those values back in to check that we got the answer right. Any other high points and low points that we want to throw up there?
I probably got, even though I didn't know how to do it, I got a little anxious thinking I had to put my information in the chat. I had to solve it myself and put it in the chat.
Okay.
Because I preferred to write it in my notebook, and the chat seemed cumbersome for typing in it, the equation type things.
Great. So that's a low point. A little bit anxious, so it wasn't your lowest point. But a possible social.
Can I ask a clarifier, Bill?
Yeah.
Do we label these as we do the points? Do we label them with the reason why they were high and or low?
Yeah, so that's the next thing that we would do is go through and describe why each of these was high and low. So, Melissa, your low point was that it was going too slowly. That's why,
yeah.
Right? Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Right.
And Bobby's, you want his high point or his low point?
So you got the answer right, so you were excited about that. And what about Bobby? What was the reason for the high point was similar?
The high point
right?
Being the numbers for both variables for Bobby.
Mm-hmm.
And the low point was not checking to make sure the answer was correct.
Okay. And then we would go through, if we were doing a really thorough job, and kind of fill in all of the ups and downs for different students. Each student would have kind of their own ups and downs, and then you would investigate why, okay? So that actually leads you right into the conversation about what the barriers are to the learning. So this example of a low point from Melissa is that as we were solving the equation, it was going far too slow for her. So that indicates that there's a possible barrier right there, at least for Melissa. For others, however, it might have been going too fast. So this is one of the difficulties, especially in a math class, around pacing as a potential barrier to learning. Anybody identify any other barriers in this lesson?
Well, I think my other low point about the chat, I think that only having one way to show my work was a barrier.
That's great. So we could imagine in a classroom that there might be lots of different ways to show your work, and so we wouldn't be limited to just providing that one way of showing the work. Jacqueline is back. Her low point was to have the exemplar as a support. So when you were solving the equation on your own, to not have it there as a support? She's typing more, so we'll come, oh, my high point was when Bill modeled it. Okay, so the modeling was in here. This one is Jacqueline.
And she did clarify that, yes, she wanted the exemplar when she was solving it on her own.
Got it. Yeah, that was I included intentionally lots of barriers like that where you couldn't look back. You had only one source of information. Why was the modeling a high point, Jacqueline? So Jacqueline says foreign language were her strengths and not algebra. So apparently your algebra teacher didn't approach math as a foreign language, which might have been helpful. So anyway, the idea of this is that you can identify low points and high points throughout, and when you do this with a bunch of different learners, what you end up seeing is that what's a high point for one person is actually a low point for another person. So it really displays right there on the wall the variability of your learners in the classroom, and helps you identify potential barriers to redesign. Yes, it brings you right back to high school. Mr. Zock, what a name for an algebra teacher. So I think we'll stop our journey mapping there and move on. So we did that. So thinking again about how you might use journey mapping. Because it's such a flexible tool, it can be useful in all sorts of ways. So we didn't really talk about the other lane down here at the bottom. I didn't do anything with it. But this lane here you could use for any number of things. So if you were, for instance, interested in thinking about just the engagement principle of UDL and thinking about your lessons through an engagement lens, you could map out what you do in a lesson for engagement. Map out all of the activities on top, and then along a fourth row, think about what do I do specifically for engagement. And then that gives you opportunity along the way to redesign and add in new ideas. So as I said before, you can do it to test out a new learning idea. You can do it retroactively to reflect on a learning design that you've done. If you're in a coaching situation, I think it's an excellent tool for coaches to use with teachers because they can map a lesson together and then think about the learner experience. You can even use it, as I alluded to earlier, as a tool for getting feedback from students. So you could map out all of the activities of a lesson and the materials and then use that as a tool for helping students map out their emotions, and for you to gather that information. It would have a great role in coordinating co-teaching situations. Co-teaching is one of the most challenging things, and if done well, really valuable. But it's hard to coordinate between two co-teachers. So you can use journey mapping to do that. Identifying barriers for a particular student or a particular class. If you're trying to integrate two different ideas, two different curriculum ideas, you could use journey mapping. So map out the activities of, say, a writer's workshop lesson and think about how you would integrate UDL into that. So have a UDL lane or even an engagement representation, action and expression lanes to think about how you would provide different options in a lesson of any kind. Oh, yes, making sure you have all of the right materials. That goes back to chemistry or any kind of activity, any kind of project-based activity where you need everything available to students at the beginning. So Jacqueline asked, how could we elicit feedback from a class of 20 students? So if you pre-created a journey map like this with all of the activities and materials up there and gave them each a different color, or you could do this on three or four different maps, each a different colored dot or sticky note, and just have them first go up and identify their high point, and then go up and identify their low point. And then write on a different colored sticky note or write on the map, why was that a high point or why was that a low point. They could even write it on these if you're using sticky notes. And then what you'll start to see is that different people have different high points and low points. And then that could elicit a conversation about why certain things were high points and low points. It really helps them with the process of becoming metacognitive and thoughtful about their own learning process, what works well for them and what doesn't work well for them, and it gives you some information along the way as well. So it could be almost a silent brainstorm type of protocol where you have students putting up ideas about their high and low points and why. And they can just be writing individually on sticky notes and putting them up as they're ready to do it. For younger students, you might have to do that in a much more supportive way of having everybody identify high and low points and then support the conversation around why. The other possibility is you could do in small groups. Work with a small group of people, of students, and really do it as a much more structured interview about what high and low points were and why that was. It could get busy if it's all on the same map, so you could create multiple versions of the same lesson around the room. So let's do just a quick bit of thinking. How might this help the instructor see their lesson differently? How could she use it to identify barriers? And how does this help the instructor think about their learning goal? So do some thinking, typing, throw out some ideas, ask questions. Yeah, I think it could be really useful in that context. I wish I had known about journey mapping when I was in a classroom, so I could have used it with students. I'm going to keep going because we are running short on time, and I'll jump back to questions and comments. So just a couple of quick reviews. The Universal Design for Learning guidelines are to provide, the principles are to provide multiple means of engagement, representation, action, and expression. Using those guidelines can help you minimize barriers before you even walk into the classroom. That's the goal of the guidelines. And then a process like journey mapping can help you identify barriers that may still exist. Yes, Jacqueline, thank you. I think it could be really useful for kind of immediate feedback, even to just do a 5-minute journey map after you've just done a lesson when you have time to do that. Quick review on the role of UDL in all three tiers. is really to anticipate any barriers that could come up with any level of intervention. There's the summary of the UDL process. There's our goal. Learning about butterfly metamorphosis. One method of representation could create a barrier. And multiple options for representation designed through the UDL guidelines can minimize barriers. Bobby, this is a great point that it can help teachers see blind spots or assumptions that they're making as barriers. I think that one of the key points is that what was kind of fake in this situation, but is very real in when you're actually doing this, is that facilitator instructor interview process can help the instructor see things that they're just assuming or that they're missing. For instance, if all of the activities along the top are just the instructor talking, then they can start to see each time I put something up, it's me talking. All right, I think we're running short on time. Thank you, but happy to answer any questions or continue conversation. Thank you all for jumping in on the journey mapping and the conversation here at the end. As you know, we have a couple more webinars in this series, which I think that Molly is probably going to tell you about in a minute.
Yes, absolutely. And I see some people typing, but I did post the link to the survey. Please complete that. We really appreciate the feedback. We will be back next Monday, December 3rd at 4:15. The topic is the language of UDL, shifting mindset. And we hope that you all will join us for that. And then the following Monday, December 10th, we'll wrap up with guideline exploration of UDL concepts. So again, we hope everybody joins us, and we'll just give it a second and see if there's any questions. Okay. It looks like everybody's just thanking you. So, Melissa and Bill, thanks again for another great session and wonderful information. We look forward to seeing everybody back on December 3rd, next Monday. Thank you, everybody.